from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight comes out of the same fabled mists of time as King Arthur and all the tales of Camelot. Sir Gawain's tale was written down centuries ago in Middle English, and the manuscript survives. Many have translated it, rendered it into modern English. Ted Hughes, Tolkien. Now comes a very contemporary interpreter with a rocking Camelot and a green knight who may stand in for all of nature with the fury of a global greenhouse. This hour on Point, honor, adventure, erotic mystery, and a modern moral in a new rendition of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. You can join the conversation. What have you heard or read in the tale of the Green Knight and noble Gawain? Ghost story, thriller, romance, morality play? And could the Green Knight be nature itself, ready to give us a counterpunch? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me today in the studio is Simon Armitage, high-flying British poet, playwright, novelist, essayist, and sometime rocker. He's won many prizes for his writing, was named Author of the Year by the Sunday Times of London. He lives in West Yorkshire in the windswept north of England, where the Middle English poem Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is rooted. His fiery new verse translation of the poem has just come out in the U.S. London's Guardian newspaper praises it for its music and its kick, its high spirits. The Sunday Times says he honors the original but never lacks for boldness. Simon Armitage, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Nice to be here.
Terrific to have you with us. An old tale made new again. This was not your thing exactly. Why did you suddenly find yourself plunging back into Middle English and Green Knight and Sir Gawain?
I think there's all kinds of things, really. I mean, you know, just from the point of view of a writer, I've been writing short lyric poems for about 15 years now, and you sort of get tired of your own voice after a little while,
right.
And you're always looking for ways and ideas to refresh that. And one of those ways is translation, you know, just the opportunity to blend your voice with another poet's voice. And I suppose in doing that, find a little bit of companionship as well, because it can be a pretty lonely thing sometimes. And then there's, you know, the general idea of bringing the poem home a little bit. As you mentioned there, it's a poem which is set in the north of England for the most part. Mm-hmm. Not exactly my part of the north of England, but mm-hmm. pretty close. Mm-hmm. And the original author was from there. we can tell that through certain dialect words. So plus I'm a narrative poet. It's a great story.
It sure is. So here you are, reaching across centuries to kind of freshen up in communion with this unknown author, or whoever wrote it down in the first place, and we'll look at that. But remind us first, and we will have people who know this story like the back of their hands, and others who may never have heard it. Give us in a nutshell the story that's told in this Middle Ages poem of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
Well, after very briefly anchoring its credentials at the Siege of Troy, it moves on very
right.
swiftly
yes.
to King Arthur's court at Camelot. It's Christmas time, and Arthur has said that he won't eat his supper until something amazing happens. And then right on cue, in comes a green knight who lays down what must seem to be an absurd challenge. He basically says, anybody here can chop at my neck with this axe if they want, so long as in a year's time I can have a chop back. And Gawain, who is Arthur's nephew and the youngest knight of the Round Table, really sees this as his chance to make a name for himself, and jumps up, cuts the knight's head off. The knight promptly picks it up, puts it back on his neck,
yeah.
and says, I'll see you in a year's time. A year goes by, and then Gawain must set out across the English countryside to find him and to meet his destiny. And a series of challenges and temptations unfold through his journey, and that's the substance and the story of the poem.
Challenges, unforeseen, battle axe challenges, bedchamber challenges. It gets there's a lot of seduction, and it's all about honor and chivalry and identity, and we'll look at all that. But let's get the sound of it in our ears, in your rendering, in your translation. There's a great bit where the Green Knight just steps into the Great Hall where the Christmas feast is underway, and he's absolutely massive, staggering, a head or more taller than anybody in the hall. I wonder if you could read a bit of that for us, Simon Armitage, in your rendering here.
Yeah, do you want me to read any of the little bit of the Middle English first?
Oh, that'd be
not?
Great.
Okay. Well, I've never really done this before.
Well,
so
let's try.
It sort of goes something like this. And all grathed in green this gorm and his weeds, A straight coat full straight, that steck on his sides, a mere mantle above, menced within. That's the noise of the original.
And we hear the sound of contemporary English woven through there, and yet it's just out of grasp. How do you render it?
I render it like this. And his gear and garments were green as well, a tight-fitting tunic tailored to his torso, and a cloak to cover him, the cloth fully lined, with smoothly shorn fur clearly showing, and faced with all-white ermine, as was the hood, worn shawled on his shoulders, shucked from his head. On his lower limbs his leggings were also green, wrapped closely round his calves, and his sparkling spurs were green-gold, strapped with stripy silk, and were set on his stockings, for this stranger was shoeless. In all vestments he revealed himself veritably verdant. From his belt hooks and buckle to the baubles and gems arrayed so richly around his costume and adorning the saddle stitched onto silk, all the details of his dress are difficult to describe, embroidered as it was with butterflies and birds, green beads emblazoned on a background of gold, all a horse's tack, harness strap, hind strap, the eye of the bit, each alloy and enamel and the stirrups he stood in were similarly tinted, and the same with the cantle and the skirts of the saddle, all glimmering and glinting with the greenest of jewels.
All glimmering and glinting, and the knight is green, and the armor is green, and the horse is green, and the hair is
green. The
big green thing is going on. Simon Armitage reading from his new translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And we have listeners who want to get right in on the green thing. Let's invite one in right now from Spokane, Washington. Carrie, you're on the air with Simon Armitage.
Oh, my goodness. Good morning. I've always enjoyed Old English and folklore, and we were just talking the other evening about the Green Man and struggling with this. And the Green Knight is another iteration, and my God, did I see a Green Knight last night at the movies. Have you heard about the film What a Way to Go?
No, I haven't, but does it have a green hero or villain?
Oh, my God. It's an independent film of a young man's awakening to global climate change, the end of empire, and calling us up to pay attention to what we've done to the planet. And if he isn't the Green Knight in modern clothes, I don't know who is.
Okay, you're right on Simon Armitage's button here, Carrie. Simon, what about it? You're very bold in some of your translation and bold in saying this Green Knight is nature, and in the sense in which there's a myth here, the way it resonates today may be in comeuppance.
Well, I mean, clearly the original poet wasn't aware of, you know, the ozone hole and global warming or anything like that. But at the same time, it seems to me that, you know, the Green Knight is green. He is a manifestation of nature. He's not purple. He's not pink. He's not yellow with, you know, orange dots. He's green. He's the colour of the leaves and the fields. And I think what happens in the poem is that Gawain has to strike a balance with him, and it's a matter of life and death. And back then, you know, nature was as much a friend as an enemy, and that's very much true today. That hasn't changed. You know,
it's both.
Yeah, we still live with this very difficult and delicate balance. And I'm not saying that is what the poem is about, but it's definitely in there for me. And, you know, these ancient myths do offer themselves up for contemporary interpretation. That is their strength.
Carrie, when you hear this as myth today, do you hear nature saying, give me your best shot, and a year and a day from now, I'll be back to give you mine?
I hear nature calling us to take an adult barefoot, a challenge, and put it on something that isn't paved. I'd challenge anybody out there, how many minutes did they put their naked foot on an unpaved surface this summer? We're so out of touch with nature, it's no wonder we don't understand all the messages that are screaming at us.
One thing that's happening in the poem is very much to do with the contrast of indoors and outdoors. Mm. And that goes right through as well to the sort of internal mind and the external experience. So, you know,
fine silks and robes and bedchambers inside and then outside, fury and guts and gore.
Yeah, intercut very closely with scenes of great delicacy and courtship and subtlety. You know, the nature of man laid bare.
But in the days of Castle, it was just outside the drawbridge, not miles of asphalt away. Carrie, thank you very much for your call from Spokane. Great to have you. I mean, the other thing we heard right there, right from the first reading, and you remark on it, is that alliteration all throughout the tight-fitting tunic tailored to his torso, and pretty soon, you know, it's glimmering and glinting in greenest jewels. Is that the physical fact of the original here as well? Are you picking up on what was?
That's right. The original is a very technically accomplished piece of work. As well as these little rhyming sections at the end, which are known as the bob and wheel parts of the poem. The main stock of the poem has, each line has two, sometimes three, sometimes four, sometimes five alliterating syllables. And a great many contemporary translations have chosen to ignore this because it takes you away from the meaning of the original words.
And gets you into the actual sense on the eardrum of all that tat-a-tat-tat.
Yeah, and for me, that's what the poem is. The whole engine of the poem is there in the alliteration. You take that away and what you've got is information, but you haven't particularly got poetry. And that's why I've concentrated on that, and that's why it won't be to everybody's taste. You know, there will be some purists, some scholars who say that I've deviated from some of the original meanings of the words, but that's necessary in creating a poem.
A trade-off, maybe, a little bit, on meaning, relevance, and also are you going for the sound or the literal translation. Simon Armitage is with us. He's out with a new translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. It's bloody and bold and, well, some big messages here as well. You can join us, 800-423-8255. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the myth, the legend, the relevance of the great Arthurian tale from Camelot, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Simon Armitage is with me. He's just out with a new translation. Some in the British press call it a kind of rocking, almost rock and roll translation. But it's serious and beautiful and conveys this very old story with a tremendous relevance right now. You can join the conversation as well. What do you think? Are you still open to the charms of knights and challenges and Camelot? How about beheadings and bloodlust and bedlust and gore? Have you read Sir Gawain and the Green Knight? In whose translation? And what do you make of this crazy story? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-8255. Talk. In the 1984 film Sword of the Valiant, The Legend of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, Sean Connery plays the mysterious warrior at the center of the drama. Here he issues his challenge to the Knights of the Round Table.
Let any man among you worthy of the deed take up my axe and hack the head from off my shoulders. Fear not, brave knights. I shall not move, nor flinch, nor seek to defend myself in any way. I am ready for the blow, but one blow and no more. And I have but one demand. Afterwards, if the power is left to me, I have the right to return the blow in like manner.
A young Sean Connery in 1984 playing out a bit of it. Of course, that return blow in the poem will come a year and a day later. And there's a big, big quest in that time for Sir Gawain, who takes up the challenge. Of course, the first thing he does, Simon Armitage, is to make good on the Green Knight's challenge or offer to let anyone deliver that blow. And with one blow, unresisted, there's just no question it's going to be a beheading blow that he will attempt. I wish you'd read for us in your translation where Sir Gawain does just that.
Yeah, this is a little bit of the Middle English to begin with. Gawain gripped to his axe and geddes hit on height, the kay for unt the fold he before set. Gawain grips the axe and heaves it heavenwards, plants his left foot firmly on the floor in front, then swings it swiftly towards the bare skin. The cleanness of the strike cleaved the spinal cord and parted the fat and the flesh so far that the bright steel blade took a bite from the floor. The handsome head tumbles onto the earth, and the king's men kick it as it clatters past. Blood gutters brightly against his green gown, yet the man doesn't shudder or stagger or sink, but trudges towards them on those tree-trunk legs and rummages around, reaches at their feet, and cops hold of his head and hoists it high, and strides to his steed, snatches the bridle, steps into the stirrup and swings into the saddle, still gripping his head by a handful of hair. Then he settles himself in his seat with the ease of a man unmarked, never mind being minus his head. And when he wheeled about, his bloody neck still bled. His point was proved, the court was deadened now with dread. For that scalp and skull now swung from his fist. Towards the top table he turned the face, and it opened its eyelids, stared straight ahead, and spoke this speech, which you'll hear for yourselves. Sir Gawain, be wise enough to keep your word, and faithfully follow me until I'm found, as you vowed in this hall, within hearing of these horsemen.
And he's charged, Sir Gawain is, with getting to the Green Chapel. There's Simon Armitage reading from his new translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and oh, Lord, we've got it. The axe comes down, the head comes off, and yet he's rummaging around between the legs and feet of all the knights in Camelot, finds it, grabs it by the hair, opens the eyelids, and it's still speaking.
You can see why Tolkien was attracted to this poem, you know, especially if you've read or you've been to see the, you know, the Lord of the Rings films. And of course, Tolkien was one of the early transcribers of the poem, lifting it from the original, and did his own translation as well.
A bit more ornate than yours.
A bit more ornate. And in fact, in the Tolkien translation, there are times when it feels as if it's older than the original.
Right. So,
but, you know, that was his thing.
He knows how to put the curlicues on.
He certainly does.
Simon Armitage brings it to us a bit more direct, and it's wonderful to hear. You know, this story has resonated through the centuries, many, many translations, many, many performances of it. I want to hear from someone right now who does exactly that. Joining us from Chicago is Stefan Pasker. He's a medieval reenactor with a specialty in the Arthurian era, been staging reenactments for 20 years, runs a company called Autumn Tree Productions. Stefan Pasker, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Of all the reenactments you do, how does Sir Gawain and the Green Knight play with your audiences?
It actually does very well. I think it's been very well received this fall.
So, and who do you play when you do it? Are you the Green Knight? Do you lift your head by its own hair and speak to the audience?
I only wish. No, I'm actually just the director, and obviously the difficulties of actually beheading one of my actors is something that has kind of caused us to modify it slightly.
A lot of great drama here. It sounds made for Hollywood and Tolkien. How do you find audiences responding to it? What do they hear in this story? Where do they roar? Where do they get quiet with insight?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of tension, you know, with the initial strike by Gawain and then, you know, following him throughout the course of the day. And a lot of audience members will, throughout the day, ask him and come up to him with great concern. And at the end of the day, when he does receive that final blow, there's an awful lot of tension and holding a breath as the axe comes down.
So it still works and works vividly, and no doubt it would. Stefan Pasker with Autumn Tree Productions in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us. Let's go again to our listeners. Lisa in Nashville, Tennessee. Lisa, you're on the air.
Yes, I am. Hi, Tom. Thank you. Just to reiterate a little bit what he was just saying about reenactments, I think there's a really direct connection between movies and oral tradition. They're both very visceral. And what's funny to me is that the English critics of your author here are being awfully stiff upper lip, because the oral tradition in England, it was all about alliteration. It was all about using words to evoke not just images, but, you know, physical reactions.
Right. I should say Simon Armitage's translation has actually had a very warm reception, but there are many translations, and it is noted that he's going for that exactly the visceral element that you described there, Lisa. Does it speak to you? Sounds like...
there were also environmental issues going on in time. They were trying to save the... Predators were being killed.
Lisa, we're losing you in the ozone, and I'm sorry for that, but thanks very much for your call.
It's interesting that the idea of it being a sort of filmic thing's been mentioned, because it's always occurred to me that this would make a really, really terrible film. It's a great story as a poem and as a piece of writing, but the narrative structure isn't what we'd expect in a film. It would have to have a great deal of manipulation for it to be a sort of successful quest film. And I think anybody who was trying to make it into a film would find the ending sort of quite disappointing, if you like. You know, it doesn't fulfil a lot of ideas that we have about film. Somebody came to see me from a big film company, and they said to me, "Simon, we see it as a family movie." I don't think they quite figured out that I hadn't written the original, but I wasn't going to, you know, contradict them, because I was thinking about royalties, etc.
Right, of course. But take us a bit to the mid portion here. I mean, for much of the year and a day, he hangs out at Camelot.
Yeah.
From All Saints Day forward, he starts to think about getting on the road for his quest. He gets out there and very quickly runs into a wondrous, not so quickly. He goes across long stretches and he makes it to a beautiful castle in the woods. He's welcomed in, and quickly we get into a very bloody and sexually charged midsection of the tale. Describe what happens for us when he's almost to the Green Chapel, but not there yet.
Yeah, he finds refuge in a castle, and he's given another challenge there by his host. Basically, his host says, "I will go out every day, and what I win in the woods I will give to you, so long as whatever you win in the castle each day you will give to me." And again, it's an odd challenge. But of course, as soon as the lord and master leaves the house in the morning, the door of Gawain's bedchamber creaks open, and in comes the lord and master's wife to tempt and to seduce him.
And she's not subtle about it. I wish you'd read a bit for us, Simon. This is the wondrously beautiful lady of the castle on page 103. There's a bit down line 1230, maybe.
Yeah.
Where she puts it straight to him.
She does. She says, "And right here you lie, and we are left all alone, with my husband and his huntsman away in the hills, and the servants snoring, and my maids asleep, and the door to this bedroom barred with a bolt. I have in my house an honoured guest, so I'll take my time. I'll be talking to him for a while. You're free to have my all. Do with me what you will. I'll come just as you call, and swear to serve you well." You think that's pretty unambiguous.
Have you sexed it up there, Simon?
Well, yes and no. You know, if you go back to the original, she says, "You are welcome to my cause, C-O-R-S, to my body, to my being, to myself." Mm-hmm. There is subtlety and there is a pun at play there. But I think it's pretty clear what the pun is intended. You know, its intended meaning.
And Sir Gawain quickly saying, you know, it's gracious flattery, but in truth, I'm not nearly such a noble knight. But then there's a lot of resistance that goes on here. That some yielding as well. He ends up compromised in his bargain with the lord of the manor, who turns out ultimately to be the Green Knight. When they finally meet, remind us of that ambiguity in the ending that you think might give Hollywood some pause.
Yeah, they finally meet at a place called the Green Chapel, and Gawain, you know, goes down on bended knee to receive the axe strike. And
that is his death, he presumes.
He does presume. The first time the axe comes down, he flinches. The second time the axe comes down, the Green Knight swerves away slightly. And the third time, he brings the axe down and just nicks his neck. Mm-hmm. And it's because he's taken from the lady a garter or a girdle, a green
belt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is to ward off evil. So in saving his life, he's also failed the challenge because he didn't tell the lord and master that he took this from his wife. Mm-hmm. And so when Gawain returns to Camelot, it's both as a survivor but in shame as well, as a sort of a mortal person, really, as a human being.
But that's an extraordinarily high standard he's held to. He's shamed. I mean, he did bend his head for this blow from the axe from this giant Green Knight. The only thing he did was to take the girdle, the garter, the belt from the lord's wife with the hope it might save his life, and not speak of it. And that constitutes shame in this chivalrous, identity-forging world of Arthur.
It does. I mean, this is a young man who carries the image of the Virgin Mary on the inside of his shield, you know, and any lie, anything that isn't 100% honest and faithful is a failure. And yet, if it wasn't for that, he wouldn't be alive to tell the story. And I think what the poet is telling us there in the original is that Gawain is a human being. And in that sense, he's an animal as well. He's a survivor. Mm. His instincts mm-hmm. cut in at the end. And in fact, the Green Knight says to him, it's something along the lines of, your fault was that you loved your life too much. And I think what's on display there is a very animal instinct, you know, to swerve from the blade or to be offered an escape mechanism from death. And I think that's why there are so many scenes of hunting in the poem, animals fleeing for their lives and being caught. So it's a very subtle and quite complex ending.
Mm-hmm. We'll come to the hunting. He may aspire, Gawain, to the truth of divinity, but there's that reality of the flinch and the animal life and the urge to survival. So there we've got a tale that's been interpreted and interpreted and reinterpreted and translated. Simon Armitage most recently with translation. Simon, if you'll stand by for just a second, I want to welcome another voice to our conversation from Charlottesville, Virginia. Elizabeth Fowler joins us. She's a professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at University of Virginia. She teaches Sir Gawain and the Green Knight to maybe 300 students every year. That's a big turnout. Elizabeth Fowler, thanks very much for joining us. What draws all those college students to your class in 2007?
Well, they love to read it, and they love to read it right after reading Seamus Heaney's Beowulf. These poems are very much alive.
Seamus Heaney encouraged Simon Armitage to do just this translation after he'd done his Beowulf, bringing it into very kind of contemporary verse. What big interpretations do you take away from this very old poem, Professor Fowler?
Well, I think Simon's been very, very good on it, and I'm really enjoying reading his translation. The thing that I'd want to add to the conversation is how funny it is. It's a hilarious poem. And Simon catching that, the way that the end is disappointing, I think there's something very important about it. It's a quest poem that has no heroics in it. You know, it's the challenges turn out to be the weather and whether you can be good at dinner conversation, whether you can dress beautifully, right?
Resist the kisses of a beautiful woman or more.
Yeah, and remember, too, that this is Gawain, kind of late in Gawain's career historically, and Gawain has been a real lady killer before this poem. So it's like if you were going to make a great Hollywood movie out of it, it would be a movie for grown-ups. It wouldn't be a 12-year-old boy action movie. And it would be very, very funny. It would take, you know, Sean Connery is, that's a sort of awful earlier movie, but right. Sean Connery is great. He reminds me of James Bond. It would be like taking the figure of James Bond, the lady killer, and all of a sudden putting him in a movie where he's very shy and says, oh, you know, everyone in the poem has heard about him. And the lady has heard that he's a lady killer. And she says, you know, show me your stuff.
Come on, man. Right,
yeah.
Let's see.
You know, and Arthurian romances are all about adultery.
Yes. So let's go. But then he doesn't. You know, we'll look at that, the humor and the deeper interpretation. But I want to pick up on something listeners will hear right away and may have heard earlier. Simon, there's this Gawain, just articulation or pronunciation of the name. How does the UK deal with that? Is there a right and a wrong, or both in play? How does it work?
I don't know if we could say there's a right and a wrong. There's a sort of received idea, I think, of Gawain. But when I started reading the poem originally, you know, without any kind of formal education in these matters, it was just how it looked on the page, which to me was Gawain. There is one stanza in the poem where the rhythm of the line seems to suggest very heavily that it's pronounced Gawain. On the other hand, because of the alliteration, there are other and many of the moments in the poem where it seems to be saying Gawain with a heavy G. So that's the one thing in this translation where I've had my cake and I've eaten it. Sometimes I've used it as a heavy G
right.
for alliteration, and sometimes I've gone with it with the way I say it. But I don't think there is a right and a wrong way. There's a tendency to think that you pronounce it Gawain if you're posh.
All right.
I don't know how true that
well,
is.
Well, we'll be posh and populist at the same time here. Okay. Simon Armitage as the new translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Elizabeth Fowler is with us from the University of Virginia. You can join us as well. 800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the myth, the legend, the relevance of the great Arthurian tale from Camelot, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Playwright, poet, novelist, sometime rock and roller Simon Armitage is out with a new translation, and it's quite wonderful. He's with us today. Elizabeth Fowler is with us as well, professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at the University of Virginia, author of The Literary Character, The Human Figure in Early English Writing. You can join us as well. What do you make of this crazy story? And are you ready to hear the global warming green revenge theme of Simon Armitage's imagination? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Marion is calling from Rutland, Vermont. Hi, Marion. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I was excited when I heard you talking about the Green Knight and Sir Gawain, and was remembering back some years ago when I spent a great deal of time in out in nature, and was reading some Sufi things, and had come across references to the Green Knight. Sufis talk about the little black man, and at that point for me it was all about the internal journey and the ego and the war going on inside, and that particular time, I saw two hawks that were very very present in my physical presence, and one was white, and I found out later that, or very shortly thereafter, that Gawain, in one rendition, is Gawain means white hawk. So I'm looking at what Simon is saying, and I'd like Simon to tell us who he or who anybody thinks that the author of that story is. But the idea of nature and ego coming together, the kind of the implicate, explicate order, the external and the interior being the same journey, and the way we are warring on, we war on ourselves internally, and the way we war on the world. And thank you very much for the show.
Oh, Marion, you're wonderful. That's great from the Green Mountain State, no less. Simon Armitage, she's got a lot on the table there, all the way out to Sufis talking about the green one. But what about the author? What is known?
Very little, actually. And that's one of the great attractions, I think, for translators and people who worked on this poem. We know that he lived in a northern area of England. We're talking here Cheshire, Lancashire, Staffordshire, Derbyshire, that kind of. We know that from the use of words and dialect words in the poem. We think he was writing around the end of the 1300s, early 1400s, a direct contemporary of Chaucer.
Are we presuming that he's putting down in script a story from oral tradition that many would have heard for centuries even earlier? Or,
well, he's using bits of Arthurian romance, and there are also ideas in the poem which go back to themes in Irish literature, especially the beheading motif. So he would have been an educated man, probably read the Arthurian romances in French. But I think it's quite important to remember as well that at the time, this style of writing was quite old-fashioned, quite nostalgic. You know, the alliteration, it was...
Even then, in Chaucer's time.
Some people call it an alliterative revival. So it wasn't highly contemporary. You know, there was something nostalgic, maybe even a bit sentimental about the way that the poem was written. But apart from that, we know very... I mean, it's only sort of an educated guess, really, rather than any kind of certainty that makes us think it was a man. There are some clues...
rather than a woman,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, yeah. There are some clues in the poem. I mean, somewhere on the manuscript, which is in the British Library, by the way, and there's only one copy of it.
It's the very paper, the very ink, the very scratching
exactly,
of that.
Exactly, exactly. Wow. Yeah, I went to see it once and had held it in my hands, and it was
they
a great...
You.
Yeah, they did, yeah. I had to put some gloves on.
Well, good.
But what was really lovely about that was that you could see that the poem's being read. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some manuscripts in the British Library which have barely been opened, mm-hmm. but this was a piece that's being read. There's one mark on the manuscript which says Hugo de, and there's a suggestion that this is a man called Hugo de Massy who lived in that area, and there are ways of adding up the number of stanzas in the poem to make an alpha numerical value which accords with his name. Ooh. And this was something that used mm-hmm. to happen in medieval literature, but we don't really know. And
kind of a structural signature.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I hope we never find out, because mm-hmm. I like the anonymity and I like the mystery.
And Elizabeth Fowler, what about our caller Marion's perception here of an interior quest, that, you know, paralleling the exterior quest, the boar hunts and the bedchamber seduction? How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that's something that's true in all the Arthurian romances in some way. This poem is so interested in the gorgeousness of surface. You know, it loves
the glinting golden spurs,
yeah.
And
mm-hmm. yeah, the architecture, the dress, even the landscape description is just phenomenal. You could read it just for that and be thrilled. And Simon does a good job with that too. Mm-hmm. But what else there is aside from that, right? Presumably, is our truth or something about our interior experience and. That is that question, and it's left very, very open in the poem. You know, it doesn't really tell you. You know, there's Mary on the inside of his shield, and all, you know, the pentangle, which stands in all this marvelous way for various virtues. But exactly what those virtues mean, you know, everybody has to kind of figure out for themselves, I guess, in this poem.
Remind us of those five knightly virtues in the pentangle on his shield. I'm trying to remember. Oh, my goodness, are we...
No,
we're not knights anymore.
Oh, well, purity and truth. Yeah, yeah. Simon probably remembers.
There's also, when we're talking about sort of outside, inside, exterior, mm. interior. That, you know, we were talking about all the surface descriptions, the sheen and the lushness of things, mm. and the glint and the glimmering, and then suddenly, hard on the heels of that, we get, you know, the very insides of the deer. I mean, every single piece of it, chopped and cut and knifed and hung and butchered. I mean, they're amazing contrasts, and that's happening all the way through the poem, isn't it?
That's gorgeous. Your word intercut is so important, because it is kind of filmic in that way. It's cinematic. It moves back and forth between the scenes in the bedroom where dressing is so important and undressing is so important, and the dressing of the deer, cataloging of every organ in it, and it's gruesome and fabulous.
Simon, give us a bit of that. You have great gory fun with that, and it is juxtaposed to all the satin sheets of the bedchamber. The lord of the manor is out in the midst of the hunt, very, very vividly described.
Yeah. Then the shoulder blades were severed with sharp knives and slotted through a slit so the hide stayed whole. Then the beasts were prized apart at the breast, and they went to work on the grollikin again, riving open the front as far as the hind fork, fetching out the offal, then with further purpose filleting the ribs in the recognized fashion. And the spine was subject to a similar process, being pared to the haunch so it held as one piece, then hoisting it high and hacking it off. And its name is the numbles, as far as I know, and just that. Its hind legs pulled apart, they slit the fleshy flaps, then cleave and quickly start to break it down its back.
And there it is. And the dressing of a different sort is going on in the woods, and it's bloody and gory and intimately detailed here. You were talking earlier about the humor in this book. I saw examples throughout. One, early on, I don't know if it would have been read as humorous or heard, but when the Green Knight, in all of his hugeness, comes into the hall and makes his crazy claim, you know, chop my head off or give me your worst blow now and be ready to take another in a year and a day, sounds nuts. And King Arthur stands right up and says so. He says, in your translation rendering, your request, counters the king, is quite insane, and folly finds the man who flirts with the fool.
Yeah.
The alliteration is high, and so is the king's willingness to say, you're off your rocker.
No, I it's very satisfying to hear Elizabeth talk about the humor in the poem, because I hadn't expected as much as that when I started translating the poem, but it's definitely there. It's there in the rhetoric, you know, in the quips and the retorts. It's certainly there in the bedroom scenes with Gawain squirming away, you know, trying to resist the temptations. And there's this lovely bit near the end where Gawain is preparing to receive the returned blow. In the original, he says...
they're in the green chapel. The axe is in the hand of the mighty green knight.
Yeah, and I suppose we might say that Gawain is quaking in his boots a little bit. He says, in the original, he says, "But that my head fall on the stones, I cannot hit restore," which in my translation is, "Gawain confessed, I flinched at first, but will not fail. Though once my head's unhitched, it's off once and for all." I suppose he's stating the obvious there, but even in those moments of high drama and the climax and conclusion of the story of the poem, there are still little nods and winks going on between the writer and the reader there, little humorous ones.
Yeah. Elizabeth, where do you turn for humor here?
Oh, there's some. You know what I would really like to do is read some of the lines that Simon just read in translation in the Middle English.
Sure.
Can we do a little bit of that?
Let's hear it.
The gory stuff of the taking the deer apart. "Then share they out the shoulders with her sharp knives. Halled him be a little hole to have whole cedars. Sith in Brittany'd they the breast and Bryden hid in twin, and after the gargling begins on then, Rivas hid it proudly reached to the beast, void as out of antlers, and verily thereafter all the remas be the ribbers, radly they lance."
Oh, we're gargling on the blood here practically.
And actually, exactly. what's great about that is that to hear that straight after the chamber scenes, the bedroom scenes, is that in fact it's highly sexual. You know, what we're getting there is the flesh. You know, we're
carnage and the comeliness, all kind of
the carnal part that we're denied in the other sections. But that was wonderful to hear you read that. I really don't know how to pronounce those words, but that was fantastic.
I'm struck in the midst of all this with this terrible quest in front of him. I don't know if this is humor or just a kind of fatalism that any modern has to relate to. You have him. Gawain says, you know, "Hey, in the end, why should I shy away? If fate is kind or cruel, man still must try." It's sort of a man has to do what a man has to do. You just have to keep trying in this life.
He has to do his best. Mm-hmm. I think that's the task that he's set himself, and never to fall short of always doing his best and offering his best, and to do that through a code of conduct. And, he fails himself in the end. But of course, that means he's able to come back and tell the story and bring back to court a certain amount of humility, which they then incorporate into the way they dress. They decide that they will then wear, the green girdle for the rest of their days.
Right.
You might see chess sets with the round table wearing this green girdle.
It's a wonderful gesture by King Arthur. He says, "Well, okay, if you were too human in the end and wore this in hopes that it would keep you from death and kind of cheated to death in that way, well, we'll all wear it. Everyone, every knight will wear a green belt from now on."
They also laugh at him as well. I mean, it couldn't have been an easy thing to do to go back and say this. And of course, at the moment when he is humiliated and he finds out how he's being tricked, he rants. He really rants. And
because the woman was the wife of the Green Knight, it turns out. He put this seduction in front of Gawain.
That's right. And it sort of all goes back to Morgan le Fay. And he makes a huge rant against women, which is not sort of pleasant reading in the poem, but it shows Gawain at his most uncomfortable. I think that's what's going on there. But it's a real sort of litany of accusation that comes out there.
Turns out, Elizabeth, that the beautiful lady was a form of Morgan le Fay, I guess.
Well, Morgan le Fay is her old companion.
Accompanying crone, as they say.
The crone, exactly. Or the cute and the crone, Simon says at one
right,
point, which
right,
is very
right.
funny.
I stopped short of it being a cutie.
But just, let's get a call from Savannah, Georgia. Rich, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing?
Very well.
Okay, I really love the sophistication and the complexity of this poem that dates so far back. And I'm a high school teacher, and I always, you know, try to deliver that to the kids, which isn't always easy, but I just love the poem. And the question I wanted to ask is about paganism and Christianity, about how it comes together and its No, not one or the other, and actually kind of a combination of the both. If you'd speak to that, I'd really appreciate it.
Wonderful, and thank you, Rich. And we love the birds in your backyard. Elizabeth Fowler, paganism and Christianity woven right through it. All kinds of references to the Christ throughout, but also very strong pagan themes.
Yes, but none of it's theological. It kind of comes in this other way. You know, when Simon's talking about the contrasts in the poem and the way that we get the flesh in these different versions, I think that's how it comes to us. There's a kind of, material presence that we get the mythic flesh of the deer and the barbaric qualities of the head being chopped off. And then we also get the intense, civilized, you know, height of erotic intrigue and subtlety. And those somehow the pagan and the Christian kind of get subsumed into these other manners, as it were. You know, the kind of Martha Stewart versus the outdoorsman.
And hunter. Yet the mention of the Savior is again and again and again throughout this poem, Simon.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't know about sort of Christianity and paganism, but I think what we have here is both sort of, it's religious and sacrilegious, but it's not a devotional poem. I mean, Gawain has his devotion, he has his faith, but it's not necessarily the faith of the author. And I think the author feels free to switch between talking about, faith and devotion and divinity and Christ into these scenes of utter carnage and intestines. And, it's just one more of those contrasts.
Carnage, but many have said that in the end this is a story about social order. Elizabeth, do you take it that way?
Yeah, I think it's about customs and civility and, you know, why we have them and what they're good for. I mean, remember, it starts with empire burning. You know, the ashes
Troy.
Of Troy have
mm-hmm.
just been let go, and people are running away from there and beginning to make an empire, at least a nation in Britain. And that setting comes back at the very end. And I think it's, you know, under the terror of the natural world and of world events, of war, what is civility for? What is it good for? What are customs all about? Do we care about them? Can they do us any good?
Elizabeth Fowler at the University of Virginia, it's been great having you. Thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure to talk about the poem.
Simon Armitage, have you got it out of your system? Are you going to do rock and roll again now or plunge back into Middle English?
I think, I'll just probably crawl back into my hole and do some more of my own little poems. This had to be taken away from me. You can't stop working on a translation. I could even go back to this now and, tinker around with every little line, but my editor said, give it us now, stop working on it, walk away from the translation. Yeah. And I hope to do something else eventually, but I'm just not sure what yet.
Well, we love the sensibility, the beautiful alliteration, the music that you've brought to it. And we thank you very much for your time today. Simon Armitage, thanks for being
Pleasure.
With us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Simon Armitage is out with his new translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. You can continue this conversation or get the podcast at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.